what we say. Okay, welcome everyone. Tonight is March 2nd, right? March 2nd. And tonight is the 15th lecture of the series of the French Revolution. We are, tonight we're going to be speaking about the second lecture on Reb Shansel Raphael Hirsch. Reb Shansel Raphael Hirsch, we mentioned last time, he grew up in Germany. He was a Talmud of Reb Arnaz. Reb Arnaz was a Rav who had a university education, who put on the garbs of the modern either priest or the modern speaker, and he tried to take away like a lot of the attraction that the reformers were having. And here, you know, he was able to talk to the group and give him a Torah true education. This was in Hamburg, and for many years the reform movement was like stagnated. It didn't go for 20 years. It remained where it was, and unfortunately for us, it was like building from the bottom up. They were getting more rabbis, were more becoming more reform minded, and it wouldn't be for 20 years until finally they would start to sweep the boards, start to take over. Rav Hirsch was a Talmud of Rav Bernays. He got smicha from Rav Bernays at a very young age. At 22, he got smicha. He became a Rav in a very small rabbinate. And then from there, after a few years, he went to another place, which was called, he went to, it'll come to me, and this is where he had to develop his educational skills, and this is where he had to, you know, he was found himself very, very, very busy, very busy there. And then finally when this became available, and this was the, we mentioned Nicholsburg, so he decided to take over that. He decided to come to Nicholsburg. What was the place before that he was in? It was I'll remind myself. Anyway, so here he was. He became the Rav we mentioned last time. He was in Nicholsburg. This is in Moravia. And he was the Rav. Now, in his Rav, as a shteller, he had over 50,000 Jews in 52 independent, like, cities, so to speak. It probably was the biggest rabbinate, in all of Europe, if not, you know, within the top three. But it was very, very, very big. And he came in taking over everything. We mentioned last time, they were very nervous because, again, the changes, the reformers that were very successful in Germany, and now they were starting to move east to Austria. Austria is east of Germany, and the traditionalists is what they call the Frum people. They were very wary, and when we mentioned this last week, Hirsch came in. They were very nervous because he dressed a little different. He did go to university, and he had a polished German. And they were very nervous that he was like a closet reformer, and he's going to come in and change everything over. But his opening speech, his inaugurational speech, we mentioned he didn't mention, he was very, you could see from his speech that he said he's deferring to the Rabbanim of the time. And he's not looking to take, you know, undermine or change authentic Judaism, but he's there to help strengthen everything. And they, from his opening speech, he already allayed a lot of the fears of the Rabbanim there. He was, okay. Okay, so he comes in 1846, and in 1847 he's the chief rabbi. And then, just I have over here, okay, he was actually in Nicholsburg. He was only... pointer's not working. Okay, he spent 4 years in Nicholsburg, and after the 4 years, he's going to end up going to Frankfurt. He's going to end up going from 50,000 Jews to 100 Jews in Frankfurt, and like you know, but Frankfurt is really going to define him. Because we're going to see that whatever issues he had. But he felt that he can do the most in Frankfurt. He's going to go back to his native Germany, but that we most likely will not get to tonight. So what happens? This is an eyewitness, somebody who was in Nicholsburg during Rev. Hirsch's speeches. So he writes... Okay, I'm not sure if it's a battery thing or... When Rav Hirsch spoke on Shabbos morning, this is like an eyewitness account, generally from 9 until 10. So he spoke every Shabbos from 9 to 10. Men and women came from all 12 synagogues to hear him, watching him stand on the pulpit as he spoke to the congregation. One cannot help being captivated by his appearance, and in particular by his striking facial expression. One could almost see the divine spirit hovering over his head, the fire burning in his heart, and the sparks that sizzled and shot forth from his enormous eyes, revealing to everyone the intensity of feeling that lay cached in the depths of the soul. Every word aroused an insatiable desire to the listener's heart to elevate him from the base material world and rise higher and higher to the loftiest spiritual planes. He stripped away the world's physical shell to reveal the sweet spiritual fruit concealed within. His words had the power of thunder and lightning. And against this backdrop, he stood like a sentry at his post, battling for his faith. Hearing him deride the world's vanity in tones of such animated fire, the listener could only shrink to an abject nonentity in his own eyes. Behold the mighty hero with his giant axe, smashing great boulders into puny pebbles. He showed no mercy to the cruel and heartless who sought the pleasures of the material world without the thought of needs of others. Then, just as the listener's heart could no longer bear the anguish, the tone suddenly changed, and he became a soothing poet, gently feeling out a path to the delicate inner recesses of the listener's Jewish soul. His soft words were and full of tender love for every Jew, especially the poor and downtrodden, but more for the whole of creation. At such moments, a sweet light shined from his eyes and his body swelled with the grace of his holy words. Totally free of personal vanity, he embodied the Jewish soul at the height of its glory and splendor. When he touched on the history of the Jewish people, its prophets and poets, the scholars and teachers, on the ones who sacrificed their lives to sanctify Hashem's name, and on the wars and triumphs of our people, his face shone with a radiant light. Before your eyes, generations arose and flourished, and whole epochs of history passed before you. In tones of innocent reverence and awe, he evoked bold visions of the end of days, projecting in comforting terms the future, when humanity would eventually rise from the depths of exile and prophetic justice and pristine faith in Hashem, which currently lies dormant in the inner recesses of the soul, will emerge glorious to everlasting triumph. Such powerful ideas, he always aroused profound awe in the hearts of the audience. His address were given without the aid of notes or sources, and with no preparation at all. After each one, this is the speaker the one who's writing this, after each one I would go for a walk in the forest away from the city and try to retain in my soul as much of the fire I had just experienced as I can keep in my memory. And this is by Rabbi Eliyahu Meir Klugman. That's who wrote this as an eyewitness. Okay, so he had a very profound effect, influence on the people. Now, when he arrived there, Moravian Jews...
What time do they down chakras?
I know, I had to figure that out. If he's talking 9 to 10, it could be that they maybe they davened at 7 or they davened at 10. Right? Unless the rabbi spoke like for a long time and like, you know, a little bit before or after.
Well,
it seems that, you know, it I remember reading also about Rev, the Chassam Sofer also had that. It seems that all the boys from the yeshiva would daven early, and they would all go to hear the Chassam Sofer speak in the main shul for congregation. It could be that he also spoke in the middle of Shacharis, or, you know. But, okay, so I was thinking the same question. I don't know when they daven Shacharis, but... When Hirsch arrived in Nicholsburg in 1847, Moravian Jews faced restrictions on residence. Okay, so they weren't allowed to live anywhere they wanted. Marriage, which we'll see in the third paragraph what that meant. Emigration, they weren't all, you know, they weren't allowed to or leave, or they were property ownership, they weren't allowed to own property. And occupation, and their, what jobs they can go into. In addition, they were burdened with special Jewish taxes on everything from meat to candles. The most onerous restriction was the pharaonic, is that what it is? Okay. Familient laws of 1726, which at the time they didn't want the Jews to, there were too many Jews. So what they did is they said only one of the children can get married. Mm. Only the eldest son, and only after his father had died.
Whoa.
Now, of course, nobody else followed that.
Right.
But legally, you were only allowed to have one of the children get married. The rest of them, legally meaning Austria legally, they were just illegitimate according to the Austrian government. They would have to, probably they would change their last names. They would have to, you know, they would have different last names. Yeah, maybe do one of those things. Or it was hoped that Hirsch would not only invigorate the religious life of Moravian Jews, but also fight for the abolition of these restrictions. Many hoped he would usher in a new age in the political as well as religious sphere. So there is going to be something that's going to happen, but not only because of Hirsch. There's going to be what's going to happen is the, well, we'll speak about it, but this, it's going to be the Second French Revolution. Okay, which is in 1848. So it's like Hashem put, you know, like the antidote before the play, you know, before the machla, and he's going to be in this situation to be able to help the Jews because it's going to be a lot of turmoil. Hirsch is he had a certain way of doing things. A German way of doing it, and in Germany everything was very set, and everything was, you know, all through the government and all through the, you know, the religious position, and that's why he felt he wanted more control over all the different various parts of the Jewish community, and that was they weren't so willing to give up their independence, so to speak. So that's one thing that he had a hard time with.
Was Austria in Germany's control at this time?
So Austria, I wondered, did I have I don't know if I had a map of it, but Austria at this time, I don't think I made a map.
No. Left there at the bottom.
Yeah, but even still, okay.
The left.
Right, but this is Austria. There's a better map in terms of Austria was major. I'm probably going to talk about it a little bit later, but basically, when Napoleon took over, you know, was conquering Europe, he got away the Holy Roman Empire, and so that Holy Roman Empire, which had been for 1,000 years more. That's it. He did away with. But then there was like a confederation of states. And in the confederation of states, Austria and Prussia were two major, they ended up with very big states. And there were a whole bunch of other smaller little states. So So Austria was like, and had a lot of influence on the German states. I don't know if they, but it was a massive country at the time. It's much smaller today, but at that time it encompassed much, much more area. Okay. Hershey's efforts introduced religious changes. Okay, with this we met. Okay, so now what's going to happen is in 1848, I guess we start the year with the French Revolution, and we're ending the year with the French Revolution. The first revolution was in 1791, 92, and 50 years later, it's going to be the French, the next French Revolution of 1848. And it's going to, again, affect all of Europe in a different way, but very, very similar. So after Napoleon fell, so basically Europe did not want, this is bad for business, or at least bad for emperors, to have like republics and people doing what they want. So basically what they did is they put the king of France back on the throne in France, and they kept nationalism to a very, they put down nationalism. Nationalism will lead to rebellions and their own, and republics, and so then, and they basically were able to keep the lid on from 1815 to 1840 for some 30 years. So for some 30 years, and they also were very interested in keeping what they call the balance of power. They didn't want any state, any country in Europe to become more powerful than everybody else. And this way they figured everybody is the same, nobody is stronger, nobody's going to conquer anybody else. And we're also, it's good for like the elite, the kings, the emperors to be in charge. And this is the way it was for 15 years. This is the way they purposely did it. One of the people that did it, we're going to see, is a person by the name of Metternich. We'll see who was in Austria. But so comes the French in 1848. Again, it was more civil unrest. One of the things was that the king of France, King Louis Philippe of France, and Francis Guizot. Basically, they didn't like the fact that there were other political parties. They limited the press, but the French people found ways of getting around this. And one of the things they would do to get around this is they would have like parties, banquets, and at the banquets they would get up and speak their political mind. And finally, at one time, they said, "That's it, no more." And they didn't allow the political banquet to take place, and it sparked a protest. And this is called the February protest. But on February 22nd, there were large-scale protests against the government in France because they stopped this large banquet happening. And after 2 days of fighting, so Louis Philippe abdicated the throne. I mean, 2 days later. Now this, and it led what they called as the Second French Republic. Okay, the first French Republic was in the 1790s. This is the second one. The first French Republic was taken over by Napoleon. So it became, you could say hand in hand, but they all agreed that Napoleon would do well with the Republic. He kept the Republic's ideas. We went through all that. But now we had the Republic is back again. Now this revolution is going to spark no less than 50 revolutions and counter-revolutions all through Europe. So for the next year or two, all over Europe, it happened because of what's happening in France. Everybody's going to want independence. It's like everything was boiling just under the surface. And it's going to come to the top. Just, I guess, this is Hashem's way of all these ideas that were in France, that were in the West, to have it to start to come east. So Hashem gave the Jews, the Jewish leaders, 30 years to realize, you know, this is what it was there, and now let's you know, when it and it's coming, all these ideas, had to be able to deal with it here. Okay, so it caused many revolutions. The outcome, the French pressured the monarchs of Prussia, Bavaria, Austria, Sardinia, granting liberal reforms. And it just went one city after another. The one that's really okay to us is Austria because of Rev Hirsch. But this is what's going to happen. It's all over. This was Prince Metternich. Prince Metternich, he was the architect of this idea. And he lived in Austria. And his idea, again, we want to keep all the states somewhat equal. Nobody's stronger than the other. We downplay nationalism or the freedom of the press, everything. We don't want these revolutions coming out all over the place, and the kings and the emperors, they're in charge. And when this happened in France, so it had effects all of a sudden all through Europe, these revolutions happened. It was I forgot who it was that said it, but the expression was, is when France sneezes, Europe catches cold. You know, that was like, and this is it. All through Italy and Austria and Prussia. It didn't happen in Russia, because Russia, they said, not here. And they were very, very heavy-handed. So nothing had, it did not, this, all this wave of nationalism and freedom, and that did not make its way to Russia, at least not now. It's going to come in a different way. Okay. So now Metternich is breaking out in Austria, uprisings, and they said, Metternich, we want you to go, we want this, you know, and there was no army coming to protect him, and so basically he also abdicated, and he left disguised, he left Vienna disguised in a laundry truck. That's how he ended up, the end of his days, he lived the rest of his life in England. Okay, so now that's done. Now, what happened? The revolution. The revolution. Metternich. Okay, he was done. Okay, so here's a better map, and you get an idea. You see how big Austria is. Austria is the. And I apologize that this isn't laser isn't working. But you see Austria, how big Austria was, and also Prussia. So Prussia and Austria are the two major states, countries, and you see all these other countries that are there.
Where was Germany?
So that was Germany. These are all the German states. Germany didn't exist as a German country. That's not going to happen for another few years. Where Germany is going to, they're going to get everything together. They're going to become one big German country. Okay, so as you can see, all along those big red, I don't know what you call them, marks, all the different places where revolutions broke out. Okay, so you see a lot in Italy, up and down Italy, up and down in Austria, a number of places, in Prussia, in different places. There are other places that there were peaceful reforms. You know, you see also probably another 10 places or so. Okay, so, but basically, at the end of the day, after about 2 years, much of this fizzled out. The emperors with their armies ended up putting everything down, and there were some reforms that are going to be long-lasting, but overall, the expectations of what could have happened did not fizzle out. But during those 2 years, there was a lot that happened. Okay, so in Austria, in Vienna, so what happened is a whole bunch of students, and this is like in March, this is about 2 weeks after France, after March 13th, about 2-3 weeks after the revolution in France, a whole bunch of students in Vienna started marching to the Landreich, I don't know how they call it, the Landreich, they started marching to the government building. And there happened to have been two Jewish doctors among them. One's name was Goldmark, and the other was called, I don't remember his name, okay? But these two doctors got up and they said, Goldmark got up and he said, what are you guys doing here? Fischhoff was the other Jewish doctor. And they said, this is enough time for talk. If we could stay out here and talk all the time, we have to act. And that caused the students to break the doors, and they broke into the room where the government was sitting, and they handed them their petition to have a constitution. And that began. What happened is this government body started to make its way to either the king or the higher government body, and somewhere along the way, the Austrian army, which was not used to dealing with uprisings, like revolutions, they ended up shooting five students. They ended up shooting, a few were injured, but five people died. Of the five students that died, two of them were Jews. And what happened is there was a while this happened, at the funeral, there was a preacher by the name of Isaac Noah Mannheimer. Now, we mentioned Isaac Mannheimer. Originally, he was a reformer. We came across him in Germany. He had since moved to Austria. The only thing is with Mannheimer, as he got older, he got less reforming, and he became more traditional. Okay, so, but he had a name of being a reformer. He was friendly with them. Last week I mentioned that in his shul there was a organ. I was wrong. In his shul, the only thing was it was a choir. That's the only difference that he had in his shul as opposed to the other shuls. Okay, but it was a full Orthodox shul. The only thing is he had a choir, so I was mistaken last week. But he was known to be like a reform sympathizer. He was the one I mentioned last week that introduced Rav Hirsch. He was the one that gave the opening remarks, and Rabbi Hirsch did not thank him at all, because he came across Mannheimer was like the reform. He was part of the, and had he thanked Mannheimer, they would have viewed him as a closet reformer.
Oh.
So he didn't say anything, although for the next year or two, the two of them together are going to push for emancipation for the Jews. Mm. And they're going to work together. Okay, so at the funeral, this is what Mannheimer said at the funeral of the two Jews. He says, you have sanctified the name of Hashem, you have redeemed the glorious name of Israel from the disgrace attached to it by the world. Then Rav Isaac Noah Mannheimer looked out at the throng. You have wished these dead Jews should rest with you in your earth, in the same earth. Do not begrudge it that those who have fought the same battle with you, a hard battle, should live with you on the same earth, free and untroubled as yourself. So, you know, okay, so we died with you, but now let us live with you. Again, that was the idea. Someday Christians and Jews will live with you on one soil, free and unhampered like yourselves. Okay, this was a eulogy given by Mannheimer at the funeral of the five martyrs killed by Austrian soldiers. Two of them were Jews. Okay, so this was Mannheimer. Mannheimer ended up getting, there were two houses, two government bodies. It was the provincial ones, the smaller ones in the different cities, and then there was the big one, the national one in Vienna. So Mannheimer was elected to the national one. Again, it's going to happen. Bernadette appointed, when he realized they all came, he says, fine, you want a constitution, you'll have it. Make for yourself a government, and then you work it through. And basically, that's what he did. That's what he gave him. In about 2 years, he's just going to take it all back. But he's going to give it up to his nephew, I believe it's his nephew, which we'll talk about. Bernadette appointed a new nominally liberal ministers. The Austrian government drafted a new constitution in 1848. The people rejected this, as the majority was denied the right to vote. The citizens of Vienna returned to the streets from the 26th of May. So now they're back in May. What happened before was on March 13th. So now this is 2 months later. They erected barricades again to prepare for an army attack. Bernadette and his family fled to Innsbruck, where they spent the next few months surrounded by loyal peasantry of the Tyrol. Bernadette issued two manifestos on the 16th of May, which gave concessions to the people. It converted the imperial diet to a constituent assembly. So now you elected your people, so make a constitution. Here's your people, get your people and do it. So one of these people, people in this constituent assembly was Mannheimer. There probably were a few other Jews elected as well. Other concessions were less substantial, okay. And that had to do with getting Germany all together, as you could see the different states. Bernadette returned to Vienna from Innsbruck in August, and after his return, the working class populace hit the streets again in August to protest high unemployment. Government agrees, reduce wages, and here the Austrian troops opened fire on unarmed demonstrators, and again, more were shot. Again, they didn't know, they knew how to fight enemies, but not their own. Okay, now September. September, Emperor Ferdinand, who was also king of Hungary, decided now he's sending the king of King Ferdinand is in the Austrian Empire is Hungary. It's going to separate soon, but in the Austrian Empire is the Hungarian, what today is Hungary, and he sent army there because there was a rebellion there too, and at first Hungary won. That's what happened. They beat the forces of the emperor, and then when that happened, so Ferdinand now fled to Olomouc in Moravia, which was again to the right, to the east of Moravia. Okay, in December, Ferdinand is going to advocate in favor of his nephew Franz Joseph. Now, you all may be familiar with Franz Joseph. Franz Joseph was he was the king of Austria, emperor of Austria for 60 years or so. He was a long last, he was very, very good to the Jews. And as a matter of fact, the Jews, up until this time, the Jews were fighting for their emancipation. So you would think, if we all want emancipation, they would include the Jews, but it wasn't so. The non-Jews, the Christians, were saying, no, it doesn't, this all does not apply to Jews. And Hirsch, where he was, in the provincial area where of Nikolsburg, in the west, northwest of Austria, so he was also fighting his fight to try to get the Jews emancipated. It's going to all end up that in a few years later, the emperor, which is Franz Joseph, is going to give the Jews everything they want. They're not going to get it through the revolution, but the revolution in itself is going to be put down, but they're going to get it through the next emperor, Emperor Franz Joseph. Franz Joseph I granted the Jews equal rights, saying civil rights in the country's policy is not contingent on people's religion. The emperor was well-liked by the Jews, who, as a token of appreciation, wrote prayers and songs about him that were printed in Jewish prayer books. In 1849, the emperor canceled the prohibition against Jews organizing within a community. And in 1852, new regulations for the Jewish community were set. In 1867, Jews were formally received full equal rights. So he's the one that's going to do that. In 1869, this is a famous visit, Franz Joseph actually came to Jerusalem. He visited Yerushalayim. He was greeted with great admiration by the Jews there. I think it was Rav Meir Orbach. He was the rub there, and he said to Franz Joseph, he wanted to give Franz Joseph a bracha. He said, "My father gave your uncle a bracha, and I want to give you the bracha. And he was very touched, he was very moved by that. And he got a bracha, I believe it was from Meir Auerbach, who was the chief rabbi of Jerusalem at the time, the rabbi there. The emperor established a fund aimed at financing the establishment of Jewish institutions. In addition, established the Talmudic School of Rabbis in Budapest. During the 1890s, several Jews were elected to the Austrian Reichstag. Okay, he's going to be all the way up into the 1900s. He's going to be a very, very long-lasting emperor. Okay, now Rav Hirsch, he himself was very, very active trying to get the Jews free. That was high on his agenda. Now, he was working. He wasn't in the main Reichstag, like main government building, government body like Mannheim was, but he was provincial. But he was more working like the Stadlan in the old days, where you work back door. You know, you get to meet different governors and different people, and you try to, you know, whether it's you're greasing a few palms or you're talking to individuals and you're trying to get them to convince them to include the Jews in full rights and full emancipation. What ended up happening is the government is going to move closer to where Hirsch was. So therefore Hirsch, the main government is going to be nearby, so he's going to have an opportunity to speak to many of these leaders. Okay, and then I just wanted to just get to the, okay, while Hirsch was talking, and they were going to set out laws or put out, make laws to include the Jews to give them their independence or equal rights, there were riots, you know, the non-Jews rioted, and then the Jews in the government positions were afraid to give the Jews their independence. And again, it's not going to happen through the Constitution. It will happen through, like we saw before, Franz Joseph. Okay. Okay. Lisansky is the mayor, the governor of the area. So Hirsch did not want to be a Jewish issue. He wanted it to be an issue of all minorities. You know, because not only you had, whether it was Czechs, so you had other minorities in the Austrian Empire. So that was the way Hirsch wanted to do it. Everybody. Don't make it a Jewish question, but make it a minority question. But it didn't come out that way. So it, Lisansky, who was a mayor, took great interest in the Jewish question during the summer of 1848. And he asked Hirsch to submit a brief overview of the owner's grievances at Silif afflicted Moravian Jewry. Hirsch responded on July 14th with a 16-page letter. Now, this letter, it seemed that made it all the way through everything. This was the main letter that Lisansky submitted to the government, and that was the letter that they used to try to push for the Jewish rights. Hirsch detailed the grievances of Moravian Jewry from cradle to grave, numerous restrictions on residence, marriage, immigration, property ownership, and occupation. That maintained the delirious effects on social and familial structure in Moravian Jewry. Okay? Again, it's impossible to know whether Hirsch's personal intervention would have eventually yielded the necessary votes in favor of Jewish emancipation, but it was because of Emperor Franz Joseph dissolved the Kremlin Reichstag right before the scheduled deliberations. And in March of 1849, the emperor promulgated his own constitution, which granted civil and political rights to all citizens, regardless of religious confession. So that's it. They got it through Franz Joseph. The other thing is, now we have Rav Hirsch. Now Rav Hirsch, emancipation is a double-edged sword. Okay. Because on the one hand, it gives the Jews more opportunity, to serve Hashem better, but yet it gives the Jews more opportunity to leave religion. So it's not, you know, and he speaks about this often. He has his political philosophy, and this is in his 19 letters he speaks about this. So this is in letter 16, this is what he says about emancipation. But for Israel, I bless emancipation only if, at the same time, the proper spirit awakes in Israel, a spirit that seeks to bring about the fulfillment of our mission quite independently of whether or not we are an emancipated, ennobling us, implanting the spirit of Judaism in our minds and engendering a way of life that accords with this spirit. In other words, emancipation is only good if it makes us better Jews, right? I bless emancipation only if Israel regards it not as the goal of its mission. We're emancipated, that's it, we're finished. No, but merely as a new aspect of it, a new test, infinitely more difficult than the test of oppression. Okay, so now we have a new situation where emancipation, we have issues, our tests of what's going to be with emancipation. Today we're in emancipation, we're not in oppression. This is the tests that we've had here in America for sure. But I should grieve if Israel understood itself so little and had so little left of its own spirit that it would welcome emancipation as the end of its goals, as the ultimate aim of its historic mission. I should grieve if Israel, by worshipping emancipation as just a means to a comfortable life and a greater opportunity to acquire wealth and pleasure, were to show that it had not understood the spirit of its Torah and had learned nothing from its goals. We must become Jews, Jew in the true sense of the words, pervaded by the spirit of Torah, accepting Torah as the wellspring of our life. Then, Judaism would gladly welcome emancipation as affording greater opportunity for accomplishing our task and realizing our ideal. We could become better Jews, we could have a better influence on the world, we can keep more Torah, we can do more mitzvahs if we're emancipated. And that's why we should want emancipation. We should not that we want emancipation in order to just become richer and just, you know, live an easier life. That's not what the purpose of emancipation is. In letter 9, that was letter 16. In letter 9, that's the spirit and fulfillment of the Torah, the only treasure it has rescued, supported, and enabled it to live amidst suffering and agony, ruin and blows of unrestrained and savage fanaticism. On every page of history, Israel has inscribed with its lifeblood that it venerates and loves only one God, and that there are human values more sublime, possessions, and the gratification of one's desire. This is that we showed this all through our history of gullus, of all of our oppression. During the years of misery and contempt, our ideal could be attained only imperfectly. When we're oppressed, we can only serve Hashem so much, and so, you know, that every Jew and Jewess, through the example they provide in their own life, should become priests of Hashem, of genuine humanity. And this ideal mission awaits us. Can we deplore our fate? Okay, and that's basically it. Just the ending is, okay, so I think I'm gonna end here. What's now gonna happen is, we speak about more of this last time, he's gonna have a hard time with Moravian Jewry. In two main things. One thing is now that Franz Joseph said, you're all free, so now people did not want to be part of a community. And they felt that they did not have to support the shuls, the schools, the mikvahs, everything that was there. And that was one issue. And he wanted to get control of that again and like force all the Jews to be part of the community. That was one thing, and he was having a lot of resistance with that. The second thing is he wanted to make a yeshiva to train rabbis to be in the new modern era. But it wasn't like he wanted to have English, you know, secular studies. He's going to teach Torah. He's going to teach geography and government and sociology and all these different things. That's not what what he had in mind for his yeshiva. He had in mind for his yeshiva was to, of course, they're going to get a full, true Torah education. But they're going to have the means to use that Torah education and deal with the new challenges, the new outside government. And that's a little bit where people misunderstand Hirsch. When they see this, they say, ah, so now Hirsch, that's what he means. Torah umada, you know, that's that Torah and Derech Eretz is the same thing. But the more you read about Hirsch, that's not necessarily what he meant. He didn't mean Torah and secular education, he meant Torah. But using your Torah to deal with the outside world. So because of this, he was having such a hard time. It was then that a small group of people in Frankfurt, the whole story on how it began, but a small group of people broke off in Frankfurt from the main German, from the main Reform community, and they formed their own small little society, and they needed a rav, and they asked Rev Hirsch if he would come and become their rav, and he accepted.
Mm.
And he left the biggest rabbinate that there was at the time, Moravia, and which was, I mean, this was new yeshivas 24/7 and real high level learning, and he left that all to become the rabbi of these 100 people. Eventually, these 100 people, his community would go to be about 5,000, and this is where we all know Rav Hirsch. This is the way I used to would know all about Rav Hirsch, was his small little shtetl, you know, in Frankfurt, where that's what they wanted. That's what he wanted. They were all on the same page on this, except we'll see. But that's where the next step from Rav Hirsch takes place. Okay, so we have to decide: are we going
to
do it next week?
You have to decide.
I have to decide. Okay, so probably let's say yes. We'll do it next week. We'll probably finish with Rav Hirsch because the next chapter is Frankfurt. And we'll see. I was hoping a little bit, we'll for sure get through Frankfurt, his history on how he took a community and made a small amount of people and made an entire community out of it. That's one. And we'll see if we can get a little bit also into his philosophy, because he has a definite philosophy, as you can see here with emancipation. He has a philosophy and outlook of how what Torah should look like in a modern era, which is where we are. Okay, thank you all. Very, very much.
8:45
Okay.
No pizza.
No pizza.